This panel examines the federal and state partnerships related to immigration enforcement, including a discussion of 287G agreements and secure communities, the increasing role played by state and local law enforcement, and the impact of these federal and state immigration measures, including local community perspectives. Panelists include Charlie T. Dean, Chief of Police, Prince William County Police Department, Laura G. McHenry, Senior Attorney and Director of Training, Immigration Services, Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Atlanta, Michelle Waslin, Senior Policy Analyst, Immigration Policy Center, and American Immigration Council, and Chuck Wexler, Executive Director, Police Executive Research Reform. The panel is moderated by Maria M. Odom, Executive Director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, Incorporated. And now, here's Ms. Odom.
My name is Maria Odom, and I am the Executive Director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network. We are a subsidiary of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and the nation's largest network of charitable organizations providing legal services to poor and vulnerable immigrants all over the country. We're very happy to be here today in very good company. With us is Chief Charlie Dean. He is the Chief of Police of the Prince William County Police Department in Virginia. Chief Dean has led the department since his appointment in 1988, having first joined the department when it was first formed in July of 1970. He has had a very distinguished career and has received numerous awards and recognition for his leadership in law enforcement. We are very grateful to have you, Chief Dean. In 2007 and in 2008, Chief Dean was charged with implementing the resolution passed by the Prince William County Board of County Supervisors requiring the police department to undertake a greater role in immigration enforcement in Prince William County. Chuck Wexler is also with us today, and he has been the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, PERF, since 1993. By working with leading police executives, he has led his agency's cutting-edge work identifying, researching, and exploring the issues that are of greatest concern in policing. Most recently, Mr. Wexler oversaw PERF's work in collaboration with the University of Virginia Center for Survey Research in the commissioned evaluation study of Prince William County Police illegal immigration enforcement policy, which was first published in August of 2009. In 2010, he oversaw the publishing of PERF's report, Police and Immigration, How Chiefs Are Leading Their Communities Through the Challenges. To his right is Laura McHenry, who is the Senior Attorney and Director of Training for Immigration Services at Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Atlanta, where she represents low-income and vulnerable immigrants before the Atlanta Immigration Court, as well as various other agencies. She's residing and working in a state where there are two out of the top 12 jurisdictions with the highest numbers of ICE detainers. All of them within the Atlanta Immigration Court. Given the number of 287G agreements in the state of Georgia, Laura McHenry's work in removal defense has changed drastically, and we look forward to learning more about the impact to that community. And to her right is Michelle Waslin, who is the Senior Policy Analyst at the Immigration Policy Center. She has authored important work on post-9/11 and immigration enforcement issues, including her most recent report titled The Secure Communities Program, Unanswered Questions and Continuing Concerns, published this past November 2010. Welcome all. We have heard wonderful conversations this morning about the role of states in enacting legislation and formulating immigration policy. We've heard that Utah is at a historic turning point. We talk about needing solutions at the national level. And while the state legislatures are looking for a fix, there's actual enforcement work happening in their backyards, and that has posed a challenge to many of the folks who are here today and will be a part of this conversation. With the expansion of ICE access programs, particularly 287G agreements, and the expanded use of secured communities, which we will hear very soon, we want to have a conversation about how this is impacting the provision of legal services on the ground, but also is impacting the work of law enforcement, whose priority is to protect us, to protect our communities, to make sure that we are safe, and now they have the added challenge to enforce immigration laws at the local level. So we look forward to all the perspectives that will be presented here today. One theme I think that is that prevails in all the conversations that we've heard this morning and that we continue to hear in our communities is how divided we have become. we have many different opinions about what is happening in the communities. We have conversations that are driven by anger, by frustration, by lack of resources, by fear of the change in the fabric of our communities, by the look in the change in the look of our communities, by misinformation and the abuse of the access to information in our media and through blogs and the internet. And Prince William County has suffered the agony of grappling with this immigration issue. I believe that we have a lot to learn from the experience of the people of Prince William County and the bravery with which they have tackled the issues, which are serious and which have caused a lot of division and a lot of pain to the residents of that county. In light of who's being arrested, we are faced with the question, are the federal enforcement goals and priorities aligned with the state and local goals and priorities? We're going to hear from Michelle Wessling, and we're going to talk about ICE stated priorities with regards to their access programs. And then we're going to talk about the data that has been collected, particularly in Prince William County and other places, that show that the goals and priorities stated by ICE may not be very well aligned with the goals and priority of some of the state and local programs. Who's getting arrested? Are they the type of individuals? Are they the folks that our federal government seeks to arrest and deport? Or are these individuals who do not fall within the categories of priorities? So we will hear more about that later in this panel. I will leave it at that. As far as the process today, we will hear an opening statement from each of our panelists, and then we will all have opportunities for a dialogue. And feel free to start thinking of your questions. We will have some questions first for the panelists, and then you'll be able to ask your own. And without further ado, Chief Dean, the floor is all yours.
Well, thank you so much. First, I'd like to say we did go through quite a bit of stress in Prince William County in dealing with this new issue. When we started this, my hair was perfectly brown, and now I have wrinkles and a lot of gray hair. But seriously, in the history of U.S. law enforcement, local and state law enforcement, we have not had any significant responsibility in the area of immigration enforcement. So as I tell my story, our story, the Prince William County story, you can keep that in context. That might put it in context. Local law enforcement has never had this responsibility. I've been a police officer for 40-some years now, started out in criminal investigations, and through my years until we got we were faced with the immigration issue, at the local level, some responsibility there. The most contact I had with ICE, or INS as it used to be, had to do with fugitives who were on the run from being involved in serious crimes. So let me tell you a little bit about Prince William County and a little bit about why I'm on this panel today. Prince William County, Virginia is just south of here. We're south of Fairfax County. We have over 400,000 population today. We've seen dramatic change in our demographics. This is just an example of that. You can see in the last 10 years, the Hispanic population, for example, rose almost 200%. Then looking at it as far as the percentage-wise, by 2010, we are probably today over 20% Hispanic. So with that context, I would say that as we entered this issue of illegal immigration in our community, we saw a number of complaints from citizens who lived in a fairly homogeneous neighborhood who saw their communities changing, overcrowding, day labor centers, et cetera. Language, new kinds of stores, et cetera. So complaints came to our board of county supervisors, our elected policy board, and as a result of their mandate and their directions to me in 2006, in December 2006, I was asked as to whether we should acquire federal authority under 287G for our police officers. I said I did not think we should do that. I recommended against that, but did recommend that we put that authority in the jail. The county moved forward with that, and that was in place. Then in July of 2007, I received what I thought at that time was a surprise, a mandate that I do two things, that I acquire federal authority under 287G and that I implement a comprehensive program with their officers that they check the immigration status of anyone where they were detained and if there was probable cause to believe they went into the country illegally. Fast forward, a lot of controversy in the community, demonstrations, long board meetings, et cetera. Some months later, after I and others in the community had expressed concerns about how far-reaching this was, this original mandate, the Board of County Supervisors decided to amend that policy to the policy we have today, which is a post-arrest policy. That is, today, if we check the immigration status of anyone that is physically arrested. So if we take you into custody, regardless of any indicators of whether you have legal status or not, we will check your legal status. If you're determined not to have legal status, immigration is informed and immigration does what immigration does. We have the 287G in the jail, and anyone who makes it to the jail is screened, and the process works as immigration requires it to work. As to the federal authority for our police officers, I scaled that down as small as I thought I could to five detectives who acquired federal authority, and I focused them solely on serious crimes involving illegal aliens. So our philosophy regarding immigration enforcement is we want to be fair, lawful, and reasonable. We're going to focus on illegal aliens who commit crime. We're going to protect crime victims regardless of their immigration status, and we explicitly prohibit racial profiling. As part of our implementation, we had a significant public education program. I was involved in some 300 events talking to all sides of the issue. And as police chief, I think I needed to stay in the middle and so that I had some credibility with what I said, at least was what I believed in. So I tried very much not to get into either side of the issue. And one of the things that I feel really commend my board for, I recommended that, of course, they supported my public education program, but I recommended that we do an evaluation, a two-year evaluation. And the board funded that, and we have now completed an evaluation that was conducted by the University of Virginia and the Police Executive Research Forum, which Mr. Wexler is executive director of. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you. Mr. Wexler, would you like to continue with the conversation there?
Well, I had a full head of hair when we started this. Chief Dean is very gracious in how he tells the story. But if you look at the Prince William County story, his role and the role of the police were at the center. And in many ways, the story of Prince William County is a story of two sides trying to come to grips with something that the country hasn't come to grips with. So in some ways, Prince William County became a microcosm of the larger issues going on in the country around this issue. And Chief Dean's role was at the center of it. And he, like many police chiefs, did not ask for this role. And in fact, the issue of immigration, for the most part, has not been something that state and local police have really dealt with directly. It's always been a part of what the federal government does, what ICE does. And I might say one thing about ICE is they have a very difficult job. I want to say that because I think the country is somewhat schizophrenic about, how they want to deal with this issue. And I recognize that there are people here in this room who have grappled with this issue. So I'm not here to praise or defend or anything, but just to recognize that it's easy to, you know, disparage a federal agency. But at the end of the day, when you have 12 million people in this country who are undocumented, and you have this agency who's somehow supposed to deal with that, when the government hasn't and Congress hasn't come to grips with that, it's really a difficult position they're in. But back to Chief Dean. So if you studied, as we did with the University of Virginia, if you look at that, and there were moments in that story where you needed to have leadership, you needed to have someone stand up and talk about what the role of the police is vis-a-vis the role of the federal government. And I think the reason this was became so important was because of the history of where policing has been the last 20, 25 years, and has gone through issues of, discrimination and racial profiling, and where the police are not trusted in many communities, where crimes such as rape are dramatically underreported because the community and the police, you know, there was a lot of tension there. And so this issue because police have come a long way on all sorts of levels in terms of use of force. There's now less use of force in police departments than any time. Excessive force has been really dramatically reduced. And issues of race, while not solved, police are much farther ahead than they were 25 years ago. And the immigration issue sort of crept up on police departments. And so we looked at Prince William County directly, but we also looked at Phoenix and Maricopa County and Minneapolis and New Haven and Montgomery County here. And in all of those places, police chiefs were sort of thrust into this role. And very often, sometimes misunderstood, because it wasn't as though they were saying, you know, that people who were in this country and commit crime shouldn't be dealt with. They were saying there's a division of labor here, and we've come a long way. Because if people are afraid to come to the police, then you have crime becomes, you know, there's a difference between reported and unreported crime. Unreported crime skyrockets. And we had situations. We had a number of meetings, and I should point out the Carnegie Corporation. Jerry Mannion, who's in the room, has been a big supporter of us, and we couldn't have done this work without them. But very early on, we'd start to hear stories of, say, in Framingham, Massachusetts, a domestic violence situation that wasn't reported to the police because there was fear that if you got some young officer and started asking questions, they would be deported. That situation turned into a homicide, and you're going to get that. Or people carrying a lot of money around on them because they can't deposit it, and they don't have any way of depositing it. So that increases robberies and things like that. So the point the police were making was, look, this is a big issue. The country really needs to deal with this nationally. But at the same time, the police became problem solvers. And that's what you see in Prince William County when Chief Dean really is having to grapple between both groups and trying to make sense of it. Or in New Haven, for example, a big issue is the fact that the people here who are in this country illegally, they don't have driver's licenses. And when they don't have driver's license, they don't have IDs. That creates all sorts of problems when you stop someone. But in New Haven, they now give out some kind of ID, and I think that was the way New Haven dealt with it. Just the other day in Los Angeles, Charlie Beck realized there was a problem with people who would have their cars towed and abandoned vehicles, and they couldn't get their cars back. Well, he changed the policy, giving people a month, and whether they came back or someone else who represented them came back to get their cars back. Those kind of things made a huge difference. So across the country, Phoenix, but then you'd have flashpoints between Phoenix and Maricopa County, and I'm sure you're all familiar with the sheriff's policies out there. And so you had a police chief, Jack Harris, who's, you know, in many ways is a kind of conservative guy, having the sheriff coming in and literally rounding up people in his community or in Mesa, Arizona, and in Maricopa County. And that would create tremendous fear. And I think the police in those areas really had a responsibility to stand up and really make their positions known. I could go on. I want to just give you from, by the way, this is a report that we have done that Maria mentioned. It's available. It doesn't cost anything. You can, get it on our website and or get a copy from us. But I just want to read you, what we came up with in terms of recommendations, because I think it's important for police. I'll give you 9 of them really quickly. Officers should be prohibited from arresting or detaining persons for the sole purpose of investigating their immigration statuses. Officers should arrest persons who violate the criminal laws of their jurisdictions without regard to the immigration status of the alleged perpetrator or the victim. Local police must uphold constitutional and civil rights of persons regardless of their status. Local police must protect crime victims and witnesses regardless of their status. Local police should engage immigrant communities in dialogue about department policies and programs. Local police agencies should educate their communities about their role in the immigration enforcement, especially the legal authorities and responsibilities of local police and federal law enforcement. Local police should develop comprehensive written policies and procedures regarding handling of undocumented immigrants. Local police agencies should monitor indicators of racial profiling by employees, investigate violations, and sanction offenders. And finally, local police agencies should become knowledgeable of programs such as 287G, Secure Communities, and state-alike local initiatives to ensure that the programs meet the agency's specified goals for participation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. McKinnon.
Good afternoon. I've practiced immigration law with Catholic Charities in Atlanta for almost 6 years, and I was asked to speak today about the practical consequences of 287G programs and secure communities programs for immigration practitioners, particularly for nonprofit organizations who serve the most vulnerable of the immigrant populations. Before I get to some of the specific consequences that I wanted to highlight, I wanted to give you some statistics from Georgia, from my area of the Southeast. There are 4 counties in Georgia with signed 287G programs, Cobb, Gwinnett, you may have heard of them. They're very, very active. Hall, Whitfield, and then the Georgia Department of Public Safety also has a 287G program. Additionally, there are 4 counties in South Carolina and 7 counties in North Carolina with 287G programs in place. I mention North Carolina and South Carolina because most of the immigrants detained in the Carolinas are sent to Georgia for long-term detention because there are no long-term detention facilities in the Carolinas. And so that inundates Georgia and the direct service providers once immigrants are placed in removal proceedings. The detention facilities, there are 5 that the Georgia region, the Atlanta Immigration Court, uses. During removal proceedings, there's a Stewart Detention Facility. It's in Lumpkin, Georgia. It's about 3.5 hours outside of Atlanta. And keep in mind, most of the immigration attorneys are going to be in Atlanta because that's where the court is. So it's quite burdensome to go to Lumpkin, Georgia for hearings and to meet with your client. There's Ocilla Detention Facility. It's in Irwin, Georgia. And it's almost to the Florida border, so even more burdensome, especially for nonprofits. We don't always have the resources. We can't charge our clients for the trip. There's the North Georgia Detention Facility in Gainesville. Not as far, 45 minutes. Atlanta City Detention. And then there is one detention facility. It's Etowah County Detention Center in Etowah, Alabama. Just to give you an idea of where people go once they are encountered by police in 287G programs. Anytime an individual is detained, whether by ICE or through the 287G Secure Communities programs, he or she is supposed to be given the Executive Office for Immigration Review, the EOIR, its list of pro bono service providers. On the Atlanta Court's pro bono list, there are 5 names. There are 2 nonprofit organizations in North Carolina. There's a firm in Florida. There's a sole practitioner in Georgia, and then there's Catholic Charities. So you can imagine we stay fairly busy as the main nonprofit in Georgia and Alabama, as far as removal defense in the Atlanta Immigration Court. So with this in mind, with the backdrop in mind, there are 3 consequences as I thought about what I do day to day that I wanted to highlight. One, of course, from my perspective as a nonprofit attorney, the strain resources for all practitioners, really. But since I'm a nonprofit attorney, that's what I'm going to focus on. So because 287G, at least in my experience from what I've seen in Cobb and Gwinnett, targets universally, even including traffic offenders, this means that for us, we're inundated with requests for consultations. So it can be a two-month wait for us if you have court. We have two staff attorneys right now, including myself, who give court consultations, so it can be a two-month wait. And at some point, we suspend new intakes, new consultations, because we just have to. People don't show up, they get scared, they go somewhere else, they forget about their appointment, so we stop after a while. And a lot of that is our, I believe, unless, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, I think our name is the first on the pro bono list, so that's the first one they go to, people in removal proceedings go to. And related to that, given the state of the economy and the increased demand for our services, we found it necessary to begin to prioritize cases. We can't take every case, and so we've really had to start prioritizing what cases we take, focusing on the most vulnerable. Related to the strain resources, I wanted to highlight the Atlanta Immigration Court and the Immigration Court at the Stewart Detention Facility. I got off the ERIR's website. They handled almost 16,000 immigration matters. That can be a bond hearing, a removal proceeding, a motion to reopen in fiscal year 2010. There are four judges in Atlanta Immigration Court, and right now two at Stewart. So it's a huge caseload, a huge docket. And then if you think about one main nonprofit service provider to service the most vulnerable, it's a huge strain. And I think it's fair to say that 287G has added is a huge cause for that overwhelming caseload, that overwhelming docket that the immigration judges have in Atlanta. For example, people can wait up to 3 years for a final hearing if they're non-detained. So some of my cases are going to wait till 2013 to actually know whether they can stay here or not, whether they're successfully proven their case. And for lots of reasons, that's unacceptable. Let's see. We've also found ourselves, more so than we generally are, becoming community educators. I think part of a nonprofit attorney, it's your job to teach the community about their rights, responsibilities, especially as far as immigration law goes. But people are scared, and that goes to a later point I'm going to make. And they want to know, what do they do? Not only as far as immigration, but also what do they do for their kids? What if they're detained tomorrow? What would happen to their children, U.S. citizen children or not? Where would they go? Who could they stay with? How do they get their birth certificate? How do they get their passport? And so we find ourselves turning into quasi-social workers by needing to teach people not only their immigration law rights and what they can do under the law, but just in general, their life, what they need to do as far as their life. And then also, because of our caseloads and our funding issues, we aren't able to engage in advocacy, not direct advocacy. There's just no way, given our limited resources and time, that we could do that. So that's kind of how 287G has affected us as far as strain resources. Another area is just, in general, the change in removal defense, particularly for people detained. 287G has changed me the dynamics of representing individuals who are in detention. Right or wrong, fewer people are eligible for relief. They're caught much more readily, and so they don't have time to gather the connections that they need sometimes to qualify for relief under immigration law. There are very few remedies under immigration law as defense against deportation right now. Read the immigration laws, they're pretty strict. And so with 287G, with law enforcement participating in the enforcement of immigration law, it has changed that dynamic drastically. Again, I mentioned individuals from other states being detained in Georgia. So it's harder for their family members to find them representation because the family members are in North Carolina, South Carolina. And so everybody has the right to an attorney in removal. Government won't find it for you, but one for you, but they do have the right. So we're seeing this as interfering with that. And then lots of vulnerable populations are being caught in the 287G program who maybe we don't want to be caught in that net. Asylum seekers, victims of domestic violence, victims of violent crime, victims of human trafficking. We're seeing them in detention, and it's amazing. They're not getting bond. Some of them are not getting bond. And so they're sitting in detention. They're already victims. And so that's one huge consequence. And then just the effects on the immigrant populations in general that I see as compared to when I started practicing and now, and with 287G. People are so scared. They don't want to move. They're scared they're going to be in contact with police. They're going to get caught. Even if, and this is an important point that I think has already been brought up, even if they're the victims, they're so scared to report the crimes because they've heard from somebody in the community that if you call the police, they're going to get you also. And so lots of crimes are going unreported, lots of domestic violence, lots of child abuse. And then finally, and I briefly mentioned this, traffic violators, for example, are detained. They have no plan for their children, U.S. citizen children, immigrant children, what happens to them. They don't have formal guardianship plans in place. And so these children are coming into the state's purview, and it places a strain on the state, and it later can make reunification with the parents, whatever the outcome in the immigration process, much more difficult. So that's
Thank you.
All I have to say.
Thank you. We'll come back to a few of those points later on today. Would you like to take
Great.
Over, Michelle?
Thank you, and thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this excellent panel. And I know there are many people in the room that are very familiar with these issues, so I hope I can do it some justice. You know, now here we are nearly 10 years after 9/11 and the first real expansion of ICE partnering with state and local police and using them as, quote-unquote, force multipliers. And in those last 10 years, DHS has certainly continued to outsource this function of identifying immigrants for potential deportation. There are currently 69 287 MOAs in place, and Secure Communities is active in over 1,200 jurisdictions and expanding rapidly. The Criminal Alien Program, CAP, is in all state and federal prisons and hundreds of local jails. At the same time, we've heard earlier today that states and localities are attempting to pass legislation that would require police to contact ICE or to determine the immigration status of every person that they arrest or of people that they come into contact with. And throughout all of this, this current administration is certainly very proud of the fact that they have deported a record number of people and that many of the people that they deported are quote-unquote criminals or criminal aliens, and that a lot of this is in fact due to these expanded partnerships with state and local police. There are so many issues that I could discuss with regard to these partnerships, and I think that the other speakers have already touched on many of them. I wanted to look briefly at two issues: prioritization and transparency. So in terms of prioritization, we know that ICE has a relatively large mandate, and each year they have limited resources. They can only deport a small percentage of the total number of people who are potentially deportable in this country. Currently, they can deport approximately 400,000 people a year, according to ICE. Now, there's still some question as to whether that is a mandate or a quota, or if that 400,000 number is a ceiling. And that's an important point, because how you interpret that number really has serious consequences, as we'll see. So recognizing that ICE clearly cannot target every single person that's within their mandate, they've put forward their enforcement priorities. And this was a great first step. ICE prioritized immigrants who are serious criminals, who are terrorists, who are threats to our communities. But their policy still does allow for the continued deportation of immigrants who don't have any criminal history. And there have been some excellent studies done in the last couple of years of these programs, these partnerships at the state and local level, and also examining the ICE statistics. And it really shows that this prioritization is not necessarily being held to, or if they are prioritizing serious criminals, they're certainly not limiting themselves to serious criminals. So, for example, the GAO came out with two excellent reports on the 287G program that really showed that this program had not consistently stated its goals or made its priorities clear or targeted serious criminals. The Migration Policy Institute just recently came out with an excellent report on the 287G program, and they found that nationally, only about half of the program activity involves people who have committed felonies and other serious crimes. So half were felons or other serious criminals, and the other half is people who have committed misdemeanors or traffic offenses. And you mentioned Cobb County. In Cobb County, Georgia, MPI found that traffic offenders now account for nearly 70% of all 287G detainers. We also have information about the Secure Communities Program, and there it shows that since October 2008, when the program was created, Secure Communities has resulted in over 94,000 removals. And of those, 26% were of serious, what they call level one criminals, and 61% were low-level misdemeanors or crimes, the level three people, or non-criminals. So 61% were low-level or non-criminals. So, you know, it doesn't appear when you look at these numbers that these programs are really focusing on serious criminals, as ICE has stated. And I think one factor is definitely this fact that the federal government is relying on state and local police to identify immigrants for potential deportation. And in doing so, in some cases, they allow the local police and local politicians to push forward a political agenda, which also ends up shaping federal priorities and the federal deportation statistics. So we do know that some, and again, I say some, certainly not all, localities really want to make a political statement. Some are on record saying that they want to rid their community of all undocumented immigrants in their communities, and some think that they can use these partnerships with the federal government to do so. I think that we've already heard that this puts the police in those communities in an awkward position. And, you know, as this number of programs expands, as Secure Communities continues to expand across the entire country, and if states continue to pass laws and resolutions, then we're going to see, you know, large numbers of people being funneled from the criminal justice system to ICE for potential deportation. And so we can't only look at the role of the state and local police in how they are arresting people and identifying people and turning that information over to ICE. ICE also, of course, has an important role to play here. DHS has a final word. When they receive information about an immigrant who's in jail who could potentially be deported, ICE can choose whether or not to issue a detainer on that person. They have the discretion to choose whether or not to move forward with deportation proceedings for that person. And we are not necessarily seeing that that's happening, that that discretion is being used. When ICE says that it must deport 400,000 people a year, but you know that there are not 400,000 terrorists and level one criminals every single year, right? So does that mean that they need to fill up those remaining deportation slots with anyone, even if that person has no criminal history or was only pulled over for a traffic violation, or if that person has lived many years in the United States and has United States citizen children? So I think ICE's memos and statements on priorities are, again, a very good first step, but there's a lot of need for follow-up on how those are being implemented by ICE itself around the country and how the information is being translated to the state and local police that are partnering with them in these programs. We also need to look at detainer policies, and will the detainer guidance reflect the priorities, the enforcement priorities that ICE has put forward? And as this process evolves and as Secure Communities expands further and further and ICE is inundated, really, with information about immigrants for potential deportation, will ICE continue to deport non-criminals with strong ties to the communities? And is that really the best use of limited resources? And then quickly, I want to say a word about transparency. ICE has been more transparent in the past, I believe. There have certainly been many meetings with advocates here in Washington and around the country, and ICE has certainly shared drafts of documents and policies with us. They have certainly made more data available. But I don't think that there has been enough transparency and there hasn't been enough data on these state and federal partnerships. One example is ICE's constantly evolving website. Those of you who have tried to use the website to do some research know that one day a document or a memo might be there, and the next day it's not there anymore. It makes it really difficult to do footnotes, and that's probably not the most important thing. So, you know, we have very little information about the CAP program, even though the CAP program has been around for many years, and it sends more immigrants into federal immigration custody than any other program. We're concerned about transparency in the Secure Communities program, and this has gotten a lot of play nationwide. I'm sure you're all aware of the ongoing debate over whether or not Secure Communities is a voluntary or a mandatory program, and what's going to happen with those communities that are saying that they don't want to participate. I'm sure many of you are aware of the documents that were brought to light because of an excellent FOIA that was done a couple of months ago, and that this shows that within ICE, there was internal confusion. The terms and definitions seem to be changing with regard to secure communities, and there may have been efforts to mislead local jurisdictions. So just recently, Representative Zoe Lofgren of California actually called for an investigation into ICE officials, quote, disassembling and deceiving conduct on the question of whether local governments were required to participate in secure communities. And I also saw in my email that just today there's a hearing in the California State Assembly about a bill that would honor the right of local governments to opt out of secure communities and to set basic standards for jurisdictions who choose to participate. So this conversation is continuing to happen. But we still need more transparency and more information. And I think it's not just that ICE is not divulging information about their own internal processes, which might be somewhat understandable, but these are programs in our local communities using resources from our local budgets and impacting the workloads of our local police and having a greater impact on all of us who live in communities. More importantly, the excellent report by PERF has found that when ICE shares information and the more public outreach they do, the better the program operates in those areas. And then finally, just wanted to note that President Obama has said many times that he wants Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform. I think that's a goal that we all share. But in the meantime, I think it is disappointing that the administration continues to focus on enforcement and deportation and expansion of these partnerships with state and local police. And in effect, they're deporting those very people who they're saying they want to legalize. The president has certainly voiced his vision of a fair and humane immigration system, and he does have administrative authority. He can act now to begin to infuse this current system with those values that he professes. And I think that making some small but really important changes to these state and local partnerships could really make a big difference to many, many immigrants and their family members who are living in the United States now. Thanks.
Thank you. Chief Dean, I'd like to start with a question for you. You've now had a couple of years, about 3 years, of running these programs in your county. Help us understand the policies and the goals of your elected officials for implementing these processes to begin with, and the impact, if any, that they've had in your ability, your department's ability, to conduct other law enforcement-related activities.
Well, as I described, some of the concerns that our community had that were voiced to the Board of Supervisors and that they reacted to had to do with things like overcrowding and community quality of life issues and day laborer centers that were seen as a nuisance in some areas and obstructing traffic, et cetera. So with that background, the Board of Supervisors and the community in general felt that illegal aliens were committing a lot of crimes and that they were causing a lot of community issues and that they should be deported if they were not in the country lawfully. That was the general consensus, I think. As we went through this, what I tried to do with our public education program was to talk about what we would do and what we wouldn't do, to talk about what it was in terms of what our effort of focusing on individuals who commit crimes and protecting victims regardless of their immigration status and not being involved in racial profiling. I talked to many community and many groups from on all sides of the issue, and I talked about the fact that we have 12 million people here without status, and at that time it was like 500,000 coming into the country at a year. And as a police chief, as a local police department, it was impossible for us to have a major impact on that issue. And I've talked about our need to focus on those that pose a risk to our community, those that are violating laws, and we should spend our time and energy on that. But I talked a lot about also about the fact that we were not going to be doing under this, even the most extreme policy, which was initially put in, we were going to treat people fairly. We were not going to be involved in doing roadblocks related to immigration inspections. We were not going to do employment investigations related to trying to do immigration inspections. And I tried to temper it with encouraging people who were victims of crimes or witnesses to cooperate with the police. And over time, I think we won some of that message. We got some of that message through.
Have you seen a decrease in the reporting of crimes?
Well, it's difficult to track what's not reported. But what we have determined in the past has been we had cases where people were committing armed robberies or robberies of people walking on the street. Many of them were illegal aliens. They would be robbed, and we would know that we had a number of those cases. We would make arrests. We'd have people that the suspect would admit that they had robbed five people when we only had two reports. So that's a pretty good clue, pretty good evidence that there are other reports out there. What I would like to add, though, is as time went on and we implemented the, we continued to talk about what it was and what it wasn't, that our policy was, and about treating people fairly and protecting victims. We've done a citizen survey that the University of Virginia has done for the last 15 years in Prince William County. We pay University of Virginia to do survey, and part of that has been how do you judge your police department? The confidence of your police, did the police treat you right? There's about five questions related to that. I saw, as you might imagine, in 2007 a dramatic drop in that, particularly, and it's broken down by demographics. So particularly in the Hispanic community, which is most of their illegal community is the Hispanic community in Prince William, many of them from Mexico and El Salvador. A dramatic drop in that. But as time went on, as they saw, in my view, as they saw the reality versus the rhetoric, that confidence in the police rose again. And today it's not as high as it was in the past, but it's much better. And I'm heartened by that. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that I myself and my top staff and we went out and talked about what it is, and how we are committed to treat people in a fair, lawful, and reasonable manner, protect victims. And the harsh reality is that the law is the law. People commit crimes. They can't drive without a driver's license. They can't commit crimes without there being consequences. And we should not turn a blind eye to these circumstances. And a lot of times it's difficult to identify people that are in the country without documentation. So today we check the immigration status of everyone we arrest.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wexler. We've heard about some diminished trust in the police force based on the example by Prince William County. The report that was commissioned by the county and that your organization, your agency helped write states that illegal immigrants make up a relatively small proportion of arrestees for serious crimes in Prince William County, and a substantial majority of arrested illegal immigrants are charged with traffic offenses or misdemeanors. Is this the best use of the county's money, the county's resources, given what appears to be a misalignment with the stated priorities by ICE? What is your opinion?
Well, I'm not here. You've got the expert here from Prince William County, and I think the issue about crime across the country and the extent of crime committed by people who are here illegally is not really understood very well. And I don't think there has been a study that has been able to document it. Our experience is that it tends to be overstated. There is a perception that more people are committing crime who are here illegally. And I will say this. We don't agree with that. But I will say this. When you talk about the issue of crime and you talk about the issue of immigration, you have to sort of break it down and talk about what part of the country are you talking about. I don't think, it's the kind of issue where you can just make blanket generalizations about this issue. There are places, for example, in Phoenix where there are a lot of kidnappings and drug activity that are committed by a whole host of people. And so that becomes an issue in Phoenix. It's not the same issue in New Haven or Minneapolis, where the Somali population is. In Minneapolis, the Somali population has a whole host of other issues. Where this issue really becomes difficult, though, and I think, to your point about secure communities, I think that it's a really good question to be asking, the people who are caught up in the secure communities, how many of them are committing, actual crime versus these other offenses. Where the issue becomes difficult is a situation where they had in Prince William County where someone was here illegally and was intoxicated in a car and got in an accident and killed a nun. And so you start to ask yourself, where do you draw the line? Because while you want to focus on the serious crimes, and that's there's agreement on that, there's also this other problem. When you have something, when you have an incident like that, it creates a lot of fear in the community. And certainly in this particular case, it really, incidents when police officers, I've seen it both in Phoenix and Houston where, when police officers were killed, the two situations they were killed by individuals who were here illegally, it transforms the community, the policy, and there's a lot of pressure on the police chief to become tougher. That is not that, by the way, that is the exception. It is not the rule. We had a meeting in Washington. We met with the Attorney General. We were meeting with the Attorney General on the Arizona 1070. We had 10 police chiefs come in. Jack Harris was the police chief of Phoenix. It was actually his idea, and we worked with him on it. But we had police chiefs of Tucson and Phoenix and Los Angeles and Houston, Minneapolis, about 10 of us, because we wanted to tell the Attorney General, Eric Holder, that we were concerned about the Arizona law. And we were all set. We met in our office the day before. At 6 a.m. that morning, Jack Harris, who was here, who had flown in, called me to tell me that he had had a Phoenix police officer killed that night. And he said, I cannot go to this meeting with the Attorney General. I have to get on a plane, as he should, and fly back to Phoenix, the death of a police officer. And it was a moment at which he said, I hope that this person who killed this police officer is not here illegally. As it turned out, he wasn't. He was from Tucson and so forth. But I think this issue, sometimes plays itself out in very different ways across the country, and it doesn't lend itself to simple solutions. We say in our report that there has to be national reform. We say we have to do something about the 10 or 12 million people who are here because it puts the police in a very difficult position, very difficult position.
Thank you. I have a question for Michelle. We hear and I understand that for thousands of individuals who are being arrested for traffic violations, we may have one unfortunate DUI incident which results in the death of an innocent person. What needs to be done to help educate the community about immigrants' involvement in criminal activity? Would that help? What's the fix here? Because it seems to be the case that one incident can turn over and destroy a lot of the good efforts on the part of the police and on the part of a lot of advocates that are trying to educate folks about the crimes that immigrants are not committing. Mm-hmm. So what is the fix here?
I wish I knew. You know, my organization has done a lot of work trying to educate the media and the public about immigrants and crime levels. I think that there is this myth, this assumption that immigrants, and particularly unauthorized immigrants, are associated with high levels of crime. But we have worked very closely with academics, with experts, and all of the evidence says that that is not, in fact, the case, that immigrants are not responsible for a disproportionately high level of crime. In fact, in most cases, I believe that they commit less crime than their numbers when compared to native U.S. citizens. So, you know, we could say that, you know, and until we turn blue, but some people are just never going to believe that. You know, but I think one of the bigger problems is, even though we say that and people acknowledge that, the fact is that when our laws criminalize immigrants and when they're treated as criminals simply for being here in the United States, and when you can be deported for a traffic violation, then that, you know, unfortunately, probably it does more, it sinks into people's brains a little bit more than all the statistics and the data. So I think that, you know, in order to change people's minds about immigrant criminality, we have to stop treating immigrants like criminals.
And are they being treated like criminals? Maybe, Ms. McHenry, you can shed some light on process here. Once they come into the custody of ICE, is bond easily accessible, obtained? How are these individuals able to fight their case?
Bond depends on the ICE officer and ultimately the judge that's assigned to their case. Some ICE officers are generous. They do grant bond. But for most people, the consideration is going to be, is the person eligible for some relief here in the U.S., regardless of their criminal status? I mean, clearly, people who have aggravated felonies under immigration law and other serious crimes, they're not going to be bonded out. But it depends on, there's so much discretion. It depends on the ICE officer and the judge. And sometimes, even if they are offered bond, you know, immigration bonds are total. You pay the total amount, right? There's no guarantee. You don't pay 10%. So sometimes the bonds are $25,000, and there's just no way most of the population can pay that. So it just depends on the ICE officer and the judge.
I'd just follow up on the data part a little bit as far as the percentages of people that lack status who commit crimes. I'd say that there is very little data out there, very little trustworthy data there that slices that as well as I would like to see it. One of the reasons I asked to have an evaluation funded was so that we would know what impact we were having and how we would tweak this, et cetera. As part of our process, I asked early on in this effort that we did, asked for ICE to provide us feedback on exactly the status of we were turning information over to ICE, so I felt it was just made sense for us to get information back about where these people are in the process and who's deported, who's not. I know a number of them are not deported because we have rearrested them. But I would say to the point of, do these illegal aliens or people without status commit more crimes than others? I doubt they do. Mm-hmm. And I think I have some of the best data there is because I know what we've done in terms of checking those that we take into custody. But it's a tricky business. You have to pay attention to the details, and there's not a great deal of good data out there is what I would say. My experience at this point is a couple of years of good data, and what I would say is people without status in my community commit a lot of drinking violations. They commit a lot of driving without a driver's license violations, a lot of drunk driving charges. The Nunn case was that person had been convicted two times previously of drunk driving. Well, it's both a criminal justice system failure, and it's, you know, there's something to do with the immigration issue here, too. My view is that the more serious the crime, if someone's here illegally, the more serious the crime, the more the penalties they should serve, and the quicker they should be deported, based on seriousness of the crime.
I'd like to open it up for questions from the audience since we have about 10 minutes.
My name is Cammy, but I write for the Pakistani Spectator. I have a question for you. I have a friend named Sulekha. She is originally from India. And few months ago, she was coming back from her temple, Hindu temple, with her husband, who is white American. And they had some reddish color on their forehead. Sulekha was arrested by a police officer because police officer alleged that she has assaulted her husband. And her husband is sitting driving. And he said, no, she didn't assault me. It's just religious. But she was arrested, and she has to spend time in, under detention, and it cost her thousands of dollars in the court system. I mean, it might have pleased certain segment of your population that police is being very tough, but what kind of impression it gave to other people that, you know, these people are being arrested just because of their different look? And I could give you the phone number of my friend, Sulekha, if you need it, and she is writing a book about this.
Did that happen?
She was arrested.
Where did that happen?
In your county. She lives in Falchurch, just a couple of miles.
But she was arrested in Prince William County?
Falchurch, West.
That's not Prince William County, but if you have a complaint, I would certainly file a complaint through the process.
I'll give you her phone number after this meeting. But I mean, my question is that it's really give very bad impression about your county, that how immigrants are being treated.
To begin with, I'm not sure you're in my county. If you're in Falls Church, is that right?
Yeah.
So that's okay. Falls Church is not in Prince William County. Number one. Number two, we are very sensitive or interested in getting information regarding if anyone that doesn't think we have done a good job. So I can tell you that I have less than a handful of complaints since we implemented the immigration enforcement resolution that have anywhere close to an allegation of racial profiling. So I'm glad it wasn't in Prince William, number one, but I'd certainly give her the advice to contact that police department. I'm sure that chief just as interested as I am. Thank you.
Hi, I have, as I was listening, I wrote some notes. I've got about three things. I don't know if I can get to them all in one question. With a lot of discussion here about the crime levels of how much the immigrants actually participate in, I don't know if someone would want to speak to the catch-22 that I see of with the curtailing of services, taking away rights for driver's license, not having jobs, not having ID cards. You know, it's amazing to me that the crime rate actually is so low, you know, because that the, you know, what about the consequences of pushing people into crime because they have no other resources? So that was one of my...
Why don't we start with that one? Chuck Wexler, would you like to take that one?
Well, I think you make a good point in terms of things like, I'm not sure it pushes them into crime, by the way. It might make them easier to victimize if someone's carrying around a lot of money, cash, because they can't, you know, deposit it in an account because they don't have a driver's license. So I think on that side, and, you know, there's also obviously going to be people in that community that are going to take advantage of other people. But the thing I worry about is a situation where you have someone who is in a car and they don't have a driver's license and they fear that if they're stopped by the police, they will then be deported. And I'm waiting for this case to happen, and it's only a matter of time, and I'm sure, I know Charlie is worried about this too, is where they get into some, you know, pursuit, and, you know, they either kill themselves, the police officer, or a third party, because they're, you know, so it's analogous to the three strikes and you're out in California, where if this person knows they get arrested, they're going to go away for a long time. So I think there's some unintended consequences with the mess that we're in. That's my thought.
Okay.
One more question, and then we have a couple more in the back.
Okay. The one other unintended consequence I'm not sure if people are aware of or with the community education. I work with child abuse victims, and over half the population I work with are Hispanic. Some of them are undocumented. I have seen an increase in people afraid to report, and which Laura had certainly talked about. But also with mandated reporting and with CPS report who they screen out versus who they investigate, that law is interpreted differently in different jurisdictions all across the country. And, for example, in Virginia, there are many jurisdictions that CPS will not investigate any cases of child abuse if it's not certain age range, caretakers, close relative. They refer those kind of calls to CPS, to the police. And so for people who are already a little bit nervous about reporting, they're going to be extra nervous about reporting child abuse to the police to investigate. And on the other hand, in many jurisdictions with CPS, the mandate for CPS is try to keep families together. Maybe this family abuse allegation is something just a cultural or educational issue. But if it's the police investigating and that alleged perpetrator gets arrested, then it's going into the secure communities, and so there's this big issue. I don't know if anyone wants to speak about that, but it does create another vulnerable population increase.
Anyone want to respond?
I think it's true that some victims and people that are aware of those kind of terrible circumstances do not report because of their concern about the impacts of the immigration issue. But the fact is we work on a team approach in most Virginia jurisdictions, so they can talk mainly to the CPS workers, but I agree with you.
You know, there are some people that sometimes play a critical role, and I saw someone in Laredo, Texas, a nun that I met, and she played a critical role between DHS and the police in terms of when you have situations like that, helping to assure that person, you know, that they should come forward. But, I mean, you almost need a third party because people are going to be afraid.
I had a case where, along that line a little bit, where we had a school that was burglarized and a lot of equipment was stolen. And we knew we had a witness, but the witness wouldn't come in. We knew through a third party. So we had to meet him in another jurisdiction and assure him that we were not going to bring the immigration issue up. He was illegal. And, of course, he provided information. We solved the case, and we kept him out of it.
Please state your name. I forgot to remind you to state your name and your organization before you ask your question. We have one more question in the back, if you don't mind. Do you want to go ahead and state it now? I'm sorry, David. Go ahead. Thank you.
I'm David Martin from University of Virginia and formerly with DHS. I have a couple of comments that really key to Michelle Boston's comments, but I'd invite a response from anybody on the panel. I just want to clarify, you said if ICE is prioritizing, they're certainly not limiting themselves to serious criminals. It was never presented that that would be a limitation. Priorities are not an exclusive list, and the priorities themselves include people who do not have a criminal record. The other non-criminal categories include recent violators, people who have been involved in certain kinds of fraud, as well as people who are fugitives who have had an order. And also, I worry a lot. I think at conferences like this, there's a certain reinforcement of a kind of feeling and not an effort to try to understand how this appears to others. It's sort of a dismissal. Oh, it's just a misdemeanor. It's minor. Somebody's being removed for that. First of all, nobody's deported for a traffic offense. It's somebody who's here otherwise unlawfully who may have committed a traffic offense that brings them to the attention of ICE. But misdemeanors, a lot of people in the community treat that seriously. Okay, it's shoplifting. It's a drunk and disorderly charge, but it's serious. They're here unlawfully. Those are the people, at the very least, that we should be going after. So I think it's important to understand that. And the way the criminal justice system operates and the way the removal system operates, it can't always be kept completely in sync. There are some refinements and improvements that really need to be made, but I would submit that secure communities should be refined but should not be abandoned or greatly curtailed. It was designed to address a problem that Michelle identified. She said, in talking about 287G, ICE is relying on state and local people to identify people for deportation, if I got that right. Mm-hmm. Secure communities was designed precisely in order to avoid that. There's some other problems that have come up, but it was to say, let's don't have the locals pick and choose. Let's look at everybody who goes through the booking process. And then, of course, ICE makes choices at the time of issuing detainers. So there's some refinements. There's some difficulties. There have been some problems with the rollout, but I think secure communities, but reviews everybody, is appropriate, and I think it fits with what Chief Dean talks about. But everybody who's arrested, I believe you said, you do have their immigration status checked, and then there's a decision made about what other immigration enforcement might follow.
Thank you. Michelle, would you like to take a moment to respond?
Sure. Well, thank you, David. And perhaps I wasn't as clear in my language as I could have been. But I would also be curious to hear from you about the refinements that you think are necessary in the program. I do think to some extent secure communities and perhaps other programs were sold to the community as programs that target serious criminals. And, you know, when you do look at the statistics, we see that in some cases, the majority of people being identified through the system are not the serious criminals that we thought would be targeted through this program. And I guess I need to say the thing I always say at the end is, I think that the system could work much better in a post-CIR, post-legalization world when, you know, we could take a large number of people off the table, basically, by granting them legal status. And in that way, law enforcement at the federal and the state and local level could really focus their resources on serious threats to the community and make their work more efficient and more effective.
Thank you. I think we'll have to stop unless we may have time for one more question. Do we have one more question in the back? And then we have several hands up. But how about we take one last question back there, maybe in the red?
My name is Jessie Braga, and I'm with the PICO National Network. And I'm very interested in the post-arrest policy that you have. But I'm wondering if local police enforcement agencies would be able to take that one step further and actually choose to not send information and fingerprints to ICE or to the feds until after a conviction, especially for lower-level nonviolent crimes.
Hmm. Well, in their case, unless the person goes to jail, their fingerprints on a misdemeanor charge like shoplifting, their fingerprints would not go in until they have been convicted. But in most cases, if they wind up in the jail, their fingerprints would go in at that time.
Thank you. I want to thank all of you for joining us today and for all your insights.
For more information, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/U.S. immigration.